Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
A migraine is not like any other headache. For many sufferers, crippling pain is just one of the debilitating symptoms, often accompanied by nausea, hypersensitivity to sound and light and odor, and sometimes other odd neurological symptoms from numbness and visual disturbances to confusion and even trouble speaking coherently. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. An estimated 15% of people suffer from migraine attacks. They are a major cause of lost productivity, and they're associated with a higher-than-average risk for depression and suicide. But as common as migraines are, there are still things scientists do not fully understand about them, including why the brain sends messages that create so much pain in the absence of obvious inflammation or injury. My guest is among those who have dedicated their professional lives to understanding migraine with an eye toward preventing attacks and relieving suffering. Greg Dusor is a PhD in pharmacology with a research interest in the neurobiology of pain. He's on the faculty at the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. Greg, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
What makes a headache a migraine?
Well, there's actually a specific list of criteria that have to be met for a headache to become a migraine or to be classified as a migraine. One of the big ones is the headache. So the headache has to last at least 4 hours. So anything less than that would not be considered a migraine. The upper cutoff of migraines in terms of time is usually 72 hours, but many patients, as we know, can go substantially longer than that. There are other associated features of migraines, the hypersensitivity to light and sound that you mentioned, aura can be diagnostic for migraine. That's not something that's common in many other forms of headache. Worsening of the headache by physical activity is a diagnostic criteria. So there's a list of things that essentially have to be met for a headache to be classified as a migraine and differentiated from many of the other types of headaches that exist.
Does having one migraine make you more likely to have another migraine?
That is a question that we are extremely interested in the research laboratory. How much does any given migraine predispose you to the next one? And we're investigating mechanisms in the nervous system that can create plasticity in the nervous system and essentially predispose patients to having another migraine once they've had one. And we know that migraine is not simply one event that you have in your lifetime. Many migraine patients have more than one over the course of a year. Many migraine patients have more than one over the course of a month. If you're unlucky, you can be diagnosed with chronic migraine, which by definition is 15 or more headache days per month.
Wow.
Where at least eight of those headaches are migraine-like. So, and they can progress over time. So there appears to be some influence of migraines on the next migraine, and we just don't understand it yet.
Okay, you use this word plasticity. We've discussed neuroplasticity many times on this show, and typically it is talked about in glowing terms. It's a good thing that the brain can rewire itself.
Right.
How is it working here against the health of people?
That's a great question because we do think about plasticity in the context of learning and memory. The brain is plastic. It can change. It can change its architecture and its structure so that you remember things. When we think about plasticity in the spinal cord or the brainstem, areas where pain signaling is channeled through, it's generally not a good thing. So plasticity can go both ways, and we typically think about it in a bad sense. So if you think about migraine, there almost has to be some abnormal or maladaptive plasticity that's going on because there's no injury that you can trace the migraines back to. Migraine patients start having these attacks, and you can't trace it back to any one event in their life that they had. There are triggers, which we can get into at some point. The triggers are things that many of us are exposed to every day. You talked about stress in the lead-in. Stress is something that we are all faced with. It's unavoidable, and yet not everyone has migraines in response to stress. So that almost demonstrates that there is some plasticity somewhere in the nervous system that is allowing these migraine patients to have these attacks in response to things that all of us are exposed to, but many of us do not have migraines in response to.
How often are you as a researcher able to have in your lab a person who is actively experiencing a migraine attack?
Well, I should be careful to point out here that I am not a licensed physician. Mm-hmm. I am not allowed to work directly on people. So we don't actually get migraine patients in the laboratory to study. Of course, we can have people who work with us that naturally have migraines, okay. and we certainly like to quiz those people and tell us about your migraine and, right. and how are they triggered. But working directly on people is not something that we spend our time doing.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then. What is happening inside the brain if one were to wire up a patient experiencing a migraine attack? Could you tell with the various kinds of brain scans that are available now that this individual is having a migraine and the person in the machine next to them is not?
That is a very difficult thing to be able to differentiate. So we're getting better with the technology that we have. Probably some of the best tools that we have now are MRI, magnetic resonance imaging studies, functional MRIs, where you can look at changes in brain activity in patients before, during, and after migraines. And the nice thing about migraine is that we have ways to trigger them in people. We have drugs that will trigger migraines reliably in humans that get migraines. And the nice thing about migraine patients is that they're heroic. They will sign up to have migraines triggered in scanners so that we can look before, during, and after the migraine at what their brain is doing and try to look for something. And those kinds of studies have been done, but it's very difficult to pick anything out, very difficult to find, well, here's your problem. Here's what's going on. So we don't really know where in the brain migraines are originating. We have some ideas, the hypothalamus being one of them, but we don't know for sure, and that's primarily because we just can't see it.
Headaches are so interesting because aside from the ones that can be linked to, you know, a bonk on the head with something hard or something like a sinus infection, why does the brain make us think that there is pain within the brain when the brain itself does not contain pain receptors?
I've spent many hours in my life thinking of what is the function of a migraine, if you just want to expand that question. Why do we even have migraines? You know, pain is typically thought of as an instructive stimulus that your body is telling you, hey, whatever it is that you're doing right now, you're either going to cause damage or you're causing damage, so don't do that again. And we learn from that. We learn not to touch that hot stove. Once we do that and have that experience, we know not to do that again. But what do you learn from a migraine? What is your body telling you that it's not happy about? Is it telling you that it's not happy? And what is it trying to say to you? And we just don't know. And so it almost seems like it's a common output that the brain has to tell you that it's not happy about something that you're doing. And what you are charged with now is trying to figure out what that thing is that you are doing that the brain is not happy with. And that can be an extremely difficult thing for patients to do.
Let's talk. You mentioned triggers earlier. You know, certain smells might be a problem. Stress might be a problem. But even for a person who is predisposed to migraines, they might encounter this triggering factor one day and be fine. And then the next day or, you know, a month later, have the same thing happen and become sick.
Yep. It's one of the challenges of having migraines is that even if you can identify what your trigger is, and many patients can, but many patients cannot figure out what their triggers are. You don't necessarily know when you are exposed to that particular trigger that today is going to be the day that that trigger causes a migraine. So what people end up doing is just avoiding them altogether if it's possible to avoid them. So the number one reported trigger for migraine is stress. Of course, we all like to think that we can avoid stress.
That,
good
right.
luck doing that. It's almost impossible to do. But if your trigger happens to be something like a scent, you know, there are many patients who will not walk through the perfume section of a department store because they never know when they're going to encounter that particular scent that's going to set off their migraine. If it's something like alcohol, which is a common trigger for migraine, they may not drink alcohol at all. So they're avoiding it all the time, but you don't necessarily know that today is the day that when I have that glass of wine that I'm going to get the migraine because it doesn't necessarily always happen.
For people who can identify their triggers, are the effects instantaneous? Is a whiff of that perfume, you know, within 5 minutes you feel awful? Or could it be that you smell that perfume and you don't start to get sick for another 12 hours?
It depends on the trigger. So most of them have some kind of a delay between the exposure to the trigger and when the headache happens. That actually can make it very difficult to link the trigger to the headache. Obviously, when you touch the hot stove, you feel pain immediately. But if your trigger is something that you ate for lunch and your headache doesn't develop for 6 or 8 hours later, it becomes very difficult to tie those two events together until you have that same lunch a week or 2 weeks later and you get the migraine again and you have that happen to you repetitively. One of the interesting things about stress in particular as a trigger is that generally patients don't get migraines when the stress is in place. It's more common to get the migraine when the stress is resolved. So the classic pattern is you had a couple of bad days at work. You know, Thursday, Friday were terrible. You're driving home on Friday afternoon, getting ready for the weekend, and then that evening is when the migraine happens. And so it's almost as if the letdown from stress or the resolution of stress is what the body is reacting to. And so there can be a delay between the trigger and the actual migraine, and that just makes it a challenge to link the two.
Okay, in terms of where this pain resides, we talked about the fact that the brain itself, if you had somebody's skull open and touched their brain, they couldn't even feel it, right? But people who are experiencing a migraine can tell you where it feels like the pain is coming from. You've looked at the dura, which is one of the layers covering the brain. What do you think might be there that could explain the way we feel when we have a migraine?
This is the focus of our laboratory, as you point out. It's a great question. So we know from studies in humans that were done in the 1940s, in the early 1940s, and these were open skull surgery patients. So patients that were having brain surgery are often conscious. And so we know from these studies that were done, a couple of parallel studies that were done in 1940, that you're absolutely right. If you poke the brain, if you put chemicals onto the brain, if you heat the brain, you cannot feel it. There is no anatomical mechanism that allows that to occur. However, the meninges, and particularly the dura mater, which is the outer layer, we know that it's painful when you stimulate it. And that's what was found in those studies. And so we know that that if something happens to the meninges, to the dura mater, that you can have the pain of a headache, migraine, or otherwise. We just don't know exactly what's going on in the meninges, in the dura, before, during, or after a migraine that's causing the headache. And so that's one of the things that we've spent a lot of time doing, is looking at the nerve endings in the meninges that are signaling pain, and just asking questions about, well, what are they capable of detecting? What can they respond to? And if we can make lists of things that these nerve endings are capable of responding to, we can then be better about making a hypothesis about what could potentially be there. So we know that, of course, if you open up the skull and you poke someone's meninges, that's certainly going to be painful. We also know that if you have an infection of the meninges, meningitis, that presents with very prominent headaches. We certainly don't think that migraine patients have their skulls open and their meninges are being poked. And we also don't think that there is a bacterial or a viral infection of the meninges in migraine patients. And so our challenge is essentially to figure out what is actually happening in the dura before, during, and after a migraine that is leading to pain. So that's where a lot of our research questions have been focused.
Is there something special about the first migraine a person ever experiences?
Not necessarily. It can certainly be a surprise to that person.
Certainly.
And you often end up in the hospital because you don't know what's going on. If you've never had the migraine before, certainly if you've never had an aura and you have an aura now, you may think that there's some pathological event going on in the brain. Sudden onset of extreme headaches is often a bad sign of a hemorrhage within the brain. And so physicians can get very concerned. And you certainly want to rule a lot of things out. And so your first migraine might be accompanied with a lot of tests, a lot of questions, a lot of examinations. And then what happens at the end of that is that you say, well, you probably just had a migraine, and so you're fine. There's not much that we're going to do for you, and you wait to have the next one. Hopefully you don't, but you wait to have the next one. And you see, if you're only having one migraine a year, two migraines a year, you're as unfortunate as it is during those migraines, you're probably not going to end up in constant medical care. But 15 or more per month, you're going to be spending a lot of time at a neurologist's office.
We're speaking this hour with Greg Dussor. He's a pharmacologist with a research interest in the neurobiology of pain. He works with the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. We're talking about understanding migraine. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We want this hour to try to understand migraine, and so we're speaking with an expert on the neurobiology of pain. Greg Dussor is a PhD in pharmacology with the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org. You can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think or call 1-800-933-5372. What factors cause someone to be susceptible to migraine disease?
There's a list of things that potentially predispose people. So we know that it's substantially more common in women, 2.5 to 3 times more common in women. We don't understand why.
Is it women of childbearing age, or does it go beyond that?
So the prevalence difference between males, there really is no difference between males and females up until puberty. And then at puberty, females skyrocket. Males don't. Females stay higher than males in terms of frequency until menopause. The frequency of migraine can jump up. It can spike at menopause, but then after menopause, males and females are about the same. So there's clearly some hormonal component to migraines. Many women have migraines that are timed to specific days of their cycle, which, not that you can do anything about that, but at least you know when they're going to happen. You can potentially plan your life around it.
So do oral contraceptives work against migraine?
They can be contraindicated in many migraine patients. And it's not, there's some confusing issues associated with hormones and migraine. And so women are 3 times, two and a half to 3 times more likely to get migraines. And so you may say, well, it's the presence of estrogen or progesterone that is causing migraines in women. It's actually a little bit confusing because it's not in women. If you look at the times of the cycle when migraines are most likely to happen, it's not when estrogen and progesterone are at their peak. It's when they're falling. So it's the downslope of those hormone levels that can cause or seem to contribute to migraines. And so with oral contraceptives, it's during the placebo week that you may have a problem. So, you know, there can be situations where women are given oral contraceptives as a preventative for migraine. You just have to be careful with how you do it. Maybe that placebo week is going to be a problem, so we don't do that week. There's familial component, certainly, to migraine. So if you have a parent that has migraine, you're something in the neighborhood of 40% more likely to have migraines. If both of your parents have migraine, there's almost a 90% chance that you'll have migraines. Clearly, some familial link. We don't know whether that's genetic or not.
Excuse me for interrupting. There's a familial link, but you don't know if it's genetic. Does that mean you haven't found the gene, or you literally it could be something environmental in growing up together?
It could be. It could be something. It could be something in your diet. It could be something that you learned to cook and to eat from your parents, and they cooked the same thing and ate the same thing, and that's what the problem is. And so, We're actually getting better as a scientific community at looking at the genome. We've gotten really good at being able to sequence people's genomes very quickly and very inexpensively. And so we can now do these large genome-wide association studies and look at many, many, many people who have migraines and compare them to large numbers of people who do not have migraines and try to find that genetic difference between the migraine patients and the healthy patients. And there have been many things that have been identified in these studies, but so far, there's not one thing that you can point to and say, well, here's a variant in this gene that is present in migraine patients and not present in healthy controls. And so there's the problem. That's the gene that is causing migraine. We just have not found that yet.
There's an inverse relationship between educational attainment and migraine?
There is. There's as you move up the education ladder, there's a decrease in the frequency of migraines. As you move up the socioeconomic ladder, there's also a decrease in the frequency of migraines. We really don't understand that statistic. As with many of the statistics in migraine, we don't understand them. It's kind of a theme with the disorder. So we don't really know where that comes from. So it's not as if triggers disappear as you obtain a college education. Or, you know, your salary goes up, triggers, you know, stress certainly doesn't go away. So we don't really understand where that comes from.
And just to be clear, because there's, it's always a little bit confusing when you talk about correlations between things. It's not like someone with terrible migraines goes out and gets a master's degree and then they're cured. It's over the broader population, people
yes.
with more education or less, fewer of them have migraines.
Yes, okay. Exactly. So we don't know that there's any relationship between, and, you know, is it intelligence level? That is not necessarily always associated with what degree that you have. It can be, but not necessarily always. So, you know, we don't really know where that number comes from.
All right. What about the link to increased risk of depression and suicide rates? Is that thought to be about the experience of chronic pain, or could that suggest that there is some kind of underlying connection to mental illness and migraine?
Right. This is a question that's debated not just in the migraine field, but in pain as a whole. The comorbidity between pain and depression is high. People have tried to ask which one comes first. Are you more likely to end up with chronic pain or migraine if you first have depression? Or are you more likely to get depressed because you have pain, head pain 10 days a month? And we don't know which one is which. We don't know which one is coming first. But there is certainly a high comorbidity between the two.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Milton in Fort Worth. Hi, Milton.
Yes, I have a question regarding medications and migraines. By the way, first, I have to go in backwards to most department stores because they put the perfume section right in the front door.
You should let them know that.
I have, by the way. The question I have is, I've had migraines all my life except for the last year or so, but a doctor gave me a blood pressure medication and thought, you know, nothing else seems to be working, so try that. My question is the blood pressure medicine worked very well. And I was wondering if it had to do with, and I didn't really have that high of blood pressure, but whether it was the blood, a possible increase, stress increasing my blood pressure causing a migraine, and then the blood pressure medicine helped mitigate that migraine or whatever, or was it the fact that keeping my blood pressure low kept you from getting migraines?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I don't know the specific blood pressure medication that you're taking, but there are there's a class of blood pressure medications that is commonly given to people who get frequent migraines. They're called beta blockers. So propranolol, atenolol, you know, there's a list of drugs in this family. We don't really know exactly why those drugs are preventative. They certainly don't work in everyone, but in some people they do, as in your case, they work quite well. We don't necessarily think it's because the blood pressure is going down. There's probably some other mechanism that drug is having, and we just don't know what it is. And there's a lot of different preventative medications that are used. So blood pressure medications is one example. There are many different anti-epileptics that patients will take. So these are drugs that were originally developed for seizure, but we've figured out that they also happen to prevent the lower the frequency of migraines. There are antidepressants, traditional antidepressants. Amitriptyline is a classic example that can decrease the frequency of migraine. And when you look across the mechanisms of these drugs, there's not necessarily any pattern that emerges, and so we can't really figure out from, you know, all of these drugs work with a specific mechanism in common. That would be great, but that's just not the case, and so we don't really know. One thing that I would like to discuss, though, is the blood vessel idea. This is something that has been debated for many, 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 many decades, and I think the conventional wisdom is that migraines are caused by dilating blood vessels. And if you can just constrict those blood vessels, the migraine will go away. And that's it's a nice sounding story. It's a wonderful story, but it just turns out to not be true. There have been some issues with that hypothesis for a while. We know that not all drugs, certainly some drugs that you give to people that dilate blood vessels will trigger a migraine. But not all drugs that dilate blood vessels cause migraines. And we know that not all drugs that constrict blood vessels will alleviate migraines. Some of them do, but some of them don't. So that becomes a little bit difficult to fit with the hypothesis. And then I think the final nail in the coffin for that idea was a study that was published a couple of years ago where patients were recruited. It was about 80 patients, and this was done in Denmark. About 80 patients were recruited and given very specific instructions that when you have any indication that you're going to get a migraine, get into the hospital immediately. We want to get you in a scanner. We want to capture a natural migraine that we haven't triggered with a drug that just happened to you on its own. We want to look at your vessels. And so what the team did was image blood vessels in the brain, in the meninges, and look before, during, and after the migraine had resolved and try to see whether there was a change in the blood vessels. And there was little to no change in the blood vessels. So for something as hotly talked about in the field as, you know, of course, dilating blood vessels are the problem. If that were to be true, you would think that you would be able to see it quite easily and quite readily, and that just was not the case. It wasn't there.
Lots of people who are experiencing a migraine also have pretty severe nausea, sometimes vomiting, and other gastrointestinal symptoms. Are those just a factor of being in extreme pain, and we can see those kinds of symptoms with lots of other pain syndromes, I guess? Or is there something about migraine that is messing with the digestive system?
There's certainly something about migraine that messes with the digestive system.
Sorry, I'm sure you would put it in a much more scientific way.
There's actually a term called gastric stasis, mm-hmm. where movement through the GI tract can actually slow down to a crawl or even stop. And that is something that is common in migraine. And it turns out to be problematic because we all like to take a drug as a pill. But if you take a drug as a pill for a condition where movement through your GI tract is essentially stopped,
it's going to sit there.
It's going to sit there, and it's not going to get to where it needs to be. And so oral medications in those migraine patients that have gastric stasis often don't work. And so there's a one of the classes of drugs that's commonly used to stop a migraine, triptans. These drugs you often find as a subcutaneous injection. So you would have to give yourself an injection under the skin, and that can get it into your bloodstream when a pill might just end up sitting in your stomach or in your GI tract and not getting to where it needs to be. We now have transdermal delivery of drugs, so you can put a patch on and get the drug that way. And so you're bypassing the GI tract. And so it's an observation that's made, and it is somewhat unique to migraine, but it's an observation that's made that can be problematic for the treatment of migraine because you just can't get drugs, at least in a pill form, to where they need to go.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Diane in Wiley. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a 54-year-old African-American female who was just recently diagnosed with ocular migraine. I didn't had no idea what these were, and I did not suffer any headache with them. I only had visual disturbances on the peripheral of my vision that looked like I was looking through a kaleidoscope.
Hmm.
I had two physicians that have both confirmed the diagnosis of ocular migraines, and I, too, have hypertension, and I am also in menopause. Is there any connection to menopause with these ocular migraines? How dangerous are they? What can I do about them? Because they're really very scary.
Well, thanks for your call, Diane. And we want to remind everyone that Greg is not an MD. He is a scientist that researches pain and migraine. But I'm guessing you don't want to make recommendations
here. I'm not going to give out clinical advice here, but ocular migraine. So I would imagine that you were quite frightened the first time you had this ocular migraine, and many patients are. You don't know what's going on. You have these crazy visual disturbances.
Could it be a stroke?
What am I? Yeah, exactly. So that their ocular migraine is thought to be a different variant of migraine, where there actually is something going on in the eye, and there probably is some blood vessel component to that kind of a migraine. Is there a connection between menopause and that type of migraine? That's possible. I can't necessarily answer that one. But it's certainly, as we talked about before, the first time you have any kind of migraine, and certainly the first time you have an ocular migraine, it can be an extremely frightening experience.
whenever we have a conversation like this, and I know that you're a pharmacologist, so you may be inclined to say not at all, but people inevitably want to know, are there things that have been researched that don't involve drugs that can make them feel better?
Certainly, yeah. So, I think one of the biggest things that patients can do is first of all, to educate themselves about migraine, not just about migraine in general, but their specific migraines. What are the patterns? You can often learn a lot about where your migraines are coming from, not necessarily all the time, but you can, if you just track your day-to-day activity better. So what am I doing? What time did I wake up? What time did I go to bed? What did I eat for breakfast? What did I eat for lunch? Did I have alcohol? There are apps for your phone now where you can, where it can help you to track your day-to-day, minute-to-minute activities. And what you can sometimes pull out of that is, well, there's a pattern here. So on days when this happens, these are days that I get migraines. And so that can be very informative to you. And that's not a drug at all. Exercise, that certainly is helpful for migraine. You have to be a little bit careful with exercise because intense exercise is actually a trigger for migraine. And so you sort of have to find the right balance there and how much exercise. If you can relax yourself, deal with stress better, easy to say as we're sitting here, not so easy to do. But there are also non-pharmacological therapeutics. They're becoming more common. There are nerve stimulator devices. Some of these are non-invasive. Certainly some of them require surgeries to implant. But there are some devices now that sort of look like a headband that you can put across your forehead, and it's a transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulator. But these people are probably familiar with these for back pain. You put the electrodes on your back and you turn on the little box, and it gives you some mild shocks.
Do you need to, excuse me for interrupting, do you need to get that like through a doctor?
Yes.
Or can you go on eBay and you know what I'm saying? I'm sure there are people selling things that look like that.
There are a lot of things that you can find on the internet that I wouldn't necessarily recommend you go find. This particular device that I'm talking about requires a prescription.
We're speaking this hour with Greg Dussor. He's a PhD in pharmacology with a research interest in the neurobiology of pain. He works at the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. We're trying to understand migraine this hour. If you've got a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. This hour, we are trying to understand migraine with my guest, Greg Dussor. He's a PhD in pharmacology. He works at the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next on the phone to Fernando in Dallas. Hi, Fernando.
Yes, hello. I just had a quick question. I think you've answered a couple of them, but my mother, she has migraines, and she's always had them her whole life. And I don't have migraines like pains, but I do have, like the lady was saying, ocular migraines where I get tunnel vision pretty seriously where I can't even – I have to sit down on a couch for at least an hour before it goes away. But it only happens maybe once a year, maybe twice at the most. So it's nothing frequent, and the doctors haven't said anything. But I just wanted to know, do you think that might be something like in a genetic way, or like you were saying, it affects people, difference between male and female?
Yeah, there's certainly a familial component to it. And so the fact that you have them, if your mother has them, is not surprising. And there's so many different variations of migraine and so many different lists of symptoms and things that people deal with. And so it sounds in your case like you're lucky because it's only once a year, maybe twice a year. And what it sounds like is that you're getting the aura component of the migraine. You just don't progress to the headache. And that's not that unusual to have the aura and then not get the headache. And honestly, if you're going to choose a phase of the migraine to stay away from, you're missing out on the part that you want to miss out on. So you're not getting the headache. So that's fantastic. So they probably came from your mother in one way or another. We don't understand how and why, but you know, consider yourself lucky that you don't have the headaches.
I think it would make sense. It made sense to me that not getting enough sleep might be a trigger. I was surprised to read that too much sleep can be a trigger for some people.
Right. 7 to 8 hours of sleep seems to be ideal in the migraine world. And as you point out, not enough, 5-6 hours can be a trigger, and too much, 8.5-9 hours can be a problem. It's almost as if the brain is saying, I like this set point. And I don't want you to go above that, and I don't want you to go below that, because if you do, here is how I'm going to tell you about it, and you're going to have this migraine. That seems to, you know, we don't really know where they come from. And back to a comment I was making earlier, we don't know what the point of a migraine is. We don't know what the body's trying to tell us. If we come up with hypotheses for what the body is trying to say, it almost seems as if the brain is essentially trying to tell you, I'm irritated by something different that you're doing right now. Stop doing it and everything will go back to normal. So it's whether it's a food that you don't normally eat, a scent that you are not normally exposed to, not enough food consumption. If you skip a meal, you know, the body wants food at this particular interval. And if you miss that, that's a migraine trigger. And so, you know, insofar as we can make insight into what the brain is actually saying, it seems to be saying, well, I don't like what you're doing, and go back to where you were before.
Is there a relationship between other kinds of milder headaches and migraine? Because I think a lot of people think, oh, if I skip a meal, if I don't get enough sleep, I'll get a headache. But it's not a migraine headache.
No. You really have to meet the diagnostic criteria for migraine, which we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. And there are so many different forms of headaches. There are tension-type headaches. There's obviously, there's classic migraine. There's cluster headaches, which you certainly don't want to end up with. There's just a headache that you have when you're dehydrated, when you haven't had food. If you're not a migraine patient in general, and you haven't had multiple episodes of migraines, and you didn't drink enough water today, you were out working in the hot sun, and you know, you end up with a headache, that's normal.
That's your body telling you something.
Hey, I want water.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily a migraine. It needs to meet the diagnostic criteria.
We have an email here from Cindy in Mansfield who says, I experienced my first aura as a freshman in college and suffered for years until I discovered that food sensitivities were responsible for triggering migraines, similar to the way smells trigger migraines. Please ask if researchers understand the mechanism around histamines triggering migraines.
we don't know. So many people have actually speculated in the past that migraine is an allergy. And of course, histamine feeds into that idea. And we know that we can trigger migraines in humans with histamine. If we expose people to histamine, we can trigger migraines. Antihistamines don't necessarily work that well for migraines, interestingly enough. So you can trigger them with histamine, but you can't necessarily block them with an antihistamine. So people have speculated that migraine is an allergic response to something. And, you know, it's kind of an interesting idea. I don't know, you know, how true that is, but... if the body is trying to tell you, I don't like something that you're exposing yourself to, is it better to basically say, I'm going to give you a runny nose, watery eyes, I'm going to make you sneeze, I might make you itch, or is it better to give you a headache, this really extreme headache attack, because you probably, if you can connect what you did to the headache, you probably won't do that thing again. And so, you know, as we hear just now from this email, if you can figure out what your food triggers are, you stay away from those things.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jared in McKinney. Hey, Jared.
Yeah, how are y'all doing?
Great, thanks.
Hi.
Quick question. Whenever I was a child, I was diagnosed with ADD and was taking Ritalin. And I noticed I would have headaches and I would get frequent migraines. And, of course, the older I got, I no longer had to take Ritalin. And since then, I've never gotten a headache, and I've never gotten another migraine.
Well, certainly, stimulants, caffeine, amphetamines, variants of amphetamines, which Ritalin essentially is, they can cause headaches. We know caffeine is a big one. Too much caffeine can be a problem, and obviously withdrawal from caffeine. Anyone knows that if you're a caffeine user and all of a sudden you stop, you're going to get a headache. But it can be very problematic for migraine patients. But there's another one of these blood vessel ideas. We know that stimulants can change blood vessels. They can constrict blood vessels, and this is this kind of feeds into the vascular hypothesis. We just don't really understand the connection that well, and it's not so simple. It's not. It doesn't appear to be the case that a change in the diameter of a blood vessel is what your problem is, but it's not. It's not unusual for stimulants, caffeine, other types of stimulants to be migraine triggers.
If, as you said earlier in the hour, some kind of maladaptive neuroplasticity might be behind migraine pain, is it possible that at some point we might learn to retrain the brain to stop having migraine?
It's certainly possible. Whether that would be pharmacologically, which obviously we're biased towards as what we do, whether there's a drug that we can administer or an electrical stimulation protocol that we can administer to the nervous system to essentially rewire it to turn off that plasticity that has developed, to bring migraine patients back to the way that they may have been before they started experiencing migraines, or to turn them into the many people who don't get migraines but yet are exposed to the same thing, that is something that is under active investigation, and we would love to get to the point where we have that kind of a therapeutic. We're just not there yet.
What's in the drugs that are commonly prescribed now to prevent migraine attacks?
So there's two main categories of drugs. One is typically referred to as an abortive agent, and these are drugs that you would take at the onset of the migraine, maybe at aura, at the beginning of the headache. And what you're trying to do with those kinds of drugs is essentially prevent the migraine from turning into its full attack. And so you would only take those drugs at the onset of the migraine. And these are drugs with names like sumatriptan, naratriptan, rizatriptan, and they were many of them are generic now, but they were marketed under names like Imitrex, Maxalt, Zomig. Migraine patients are, of course, very familiar with these words. So that's the abortive therapeutics. And then there are, if you have enough migraines, if you get to the point where you're having five or six a month, you will often qualify for what's termed a prophylactic agent. Now this is something that you're going to take every day in hopes of decreasing the frequency. So not you wouldn't take it when the migraine starts. You're going to take it all the time. And your goal would be to go from five migraines to four migraines to three to two to none. And this, as we heard earlier, blood pressure medications, propranolol can be good at this, anti-epileptics, antidepressants. And so it depends on how often you have migraines. That'll ultimately determine what drug you're given. So if you get them often enough, the triptan drugs, which are the abortive agents, are generally not given to people because in some patients, you can develop a condition known as medication overuse headache. And this is a condition where the drugs that you're taking for migraine, and this is a common thing with triptans, it's also a common thing with opiates, which have really fallen out of favor for the treatment of migraine. The drugs that you're actually taking to prevent your migraine from fully developing can actually over time end up making your headaches worse and more frequent. And so and then what you have to do is essentially stop taking that drug that might have otherwise been working for you. It's just that you took it too often, and now you've gotten yourself into this medication overuse headache state where you have to stop the drug and come back down. So the drugs actually themselves that are being used to treat people's migraines can in some cases make them worse.
Is there something about getting out in front of any kind of pain that makes it easier to manage? Like it seems like when people are unwell, it's easier to get that pain to a manageable place if you take pain medication right away rather than waiting until you've never felt worse.
Right. So that's certainly true in the case of migraine. This is one of the observations that's been made by many people over time, is that the therapeutic agents like triptans, if they're taken early in the attack, can work very well. If you wait too long, hours into the development of the headache, the ability of those drugs to turn the headache off can drop off quite dramatically. And so you're right. Getting to it early is better in many cases than waiting too long and getting to it later. And we don't really understand is there time? There's a time window there, but what is the window? What's happening during that window? Why is the drug working better here than later? One of the other things is that migraine is referred to as episodic if it's less than 15 days a month, and chronic if it's more than 15 days a month. And so what can happen over time is that patients can start with one, maybe two, three migraines a month, and over time they'll go to four, five, six. And so the frequency of migraine can actually increase over time. And we know that one of the biggest contributing factors to the increase in frequency of migraines is inadequate treatment of migraines in the first place. Mm. So there are a lot of patients who do not seek medical attention for their migraines. There are a lot of patients who don't go to pain specialists or neurologists to really go after their migraines. And that's actually not helpful, because we know that not treating the migraines when they're relatively infrequent can cause them in some people to become more frequent over time. So it really is important for people to get on top of it and do whatever they can to try to stop them.
Are people who have like 15 migraines a month, are they functionally disabled?
Yeah. I mean, you can imagine that if your headache, you're having a 7, 8, 9 out of 10 pain,
yeah,
15 or more days a month, and many, you know, many patients are in the 20s, 25, and essentially they're just having headaches all the time. If you can't get around light and you can't get around sound, this intense throbbing head pain, you might imagine it being difficult to do much of anything. So yeah, they can be completely debilitating.
When you scan the research that you are doing, that your colleagues elsewhere are doing, do you think there is somewhere a cure for migraine, or do you think the ultimate we can hope for is that this is something that we are able to manage for people who are predisposed to these?
We certainly hope that at some point there will be a cure, and there are some new therapeutics coming out that look really promising. I mean, they're in late-stage clinical trials now. They're targeting a protein that your body makes all the time, calcitonin gene-related peptide. The details here don't matter. It's a protein that's abbreviated CGRP. And there are some antibodies now. So a new category of drugs is, rather than traditional small chemical molecules, to give people antibodies to various things. And that can that can block the activity of different proteins. And so antibodies to the CGRP protein look remarkably effective in late-stage clinical trials. They're not approved yet for use in humans, but those trials look very promising. And so we're hoping that those can be helpful for many patients who are not getting relief right now, and that's a lot of the migraine population. I think one of the challenges is really that migraine is so variable in terms of what the underlying pathology is and what the presentation of the migraine attack is, that there's probably a lot of different ways to get to a migraine, and that just means that it might not be one drug that we come up with that works for everyone. You might have to figure out what kind of migraineur you are, what causes your migraine, what the underlying pathology is, and then this particular drug is going to work for you.
Greg Dusor is a PhD in pharmacology with a research interest in the neurobiology of pain. He's on the faculty at the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. Greg, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Natalie Kamunkun. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email is think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.